Here we are on the Radio Gorgeous, not sofa. We're actually at the Radio Gorgeous kitchen table.
Woohoo!
And at the Radio Gorgeous kitchen table, I am very honored to have Christina Ford, who has just published her first book, In Search of Mr. Darcy, Lessons Learned in the Pursuit of Happily Ever After. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you. Hey. Delighted to be here.
And the sun has come out. Thank you. You've brought a little sunshine
it
to
us. It is all
today.
Me.
It's all you. All the time.
Yeah, exactly.
But you put all the horror into the book.
Every bit of it.
Okay, so it's a memoir.
Yes, it is.
Focused sort of around the men in your life.
Right.
And your relationships.
Yeah.
All right. So, and your search for love and romance.
Correct.
Okay. And that's sort of the structure of the memoir, although we do get loads other stuff, which we will get to shortly. But talk to me about that structure and how you started off. I think it pretty much starts off as any daughter's life does with dad.
Right. Well, but, you know, the men are sort of vehicles of where I was at certain times and the decisions we make, right? So you can look back and think, oh, you know, that was my starter marriage, or that was my breeding marriage, or, you know, you can sit there and go, and thus the guys have names attached to it. So
sort of like houses.
That was my starter house. That's exactly right. That was the family home. There's the vacation. Exactly. It's very much like that. And not all houses serve you through your life. And so it really is about the choices I've made and why we make them. And hopefully women in particular will relate to the similar themes that we go through as women through our lives and thinking, oh, we have to have the perfect relationship, or, you know, again, the title In Search of Mr. Darcy, like, you know, it's sort of debunking fairy tales. And we are told right from the beginning of Happily Ever After and Prince Charming and stuff. And then you get old enough and you think, oh, okay, well, now I'm reading literature or I'm watching different things. And I can remember watching Pride and Prejudice. This is where, like, I fell in love with Colin Firth, and I'm sure, yeah, many other women did too, and probably some men. But with the miniseries Pride and Prejudice, I was in that I go, oh my God, like, this is a fairy tale too. This is just the ultimate prize, you know, and off he whips her off to his manor house in the countryside, and they live happily ever after.
And to me, it's also, I mean, I know romance fiction gets a bad rep. Jane Austen is nothing if not a romance novelist.
It's true. In all of her things, it's about the guy and then finding the guy. But it's important to note that she never married.
She knew better.
So I don't know what that's all about. But, you know, I'm going to guess that she's been read fairy tales through her life for sure. Yeah.
Okay, so tell me a bit about your dad, because your parents sounded so delightful and unusual and charming and just huge influences in your life.
Yeah, they were a very unique couple. Mm. They were married for 56 years and they died within 4 months of each other. My father, British journalist, and my mother, who was this Russian beauty queen who won a contest and brought her to Canada, which is where I was raised. And my dad's only single tool in his parenting arsenal was his sense of humor. And often it would come at the expense of others, right? Like this was not for the faint of heart. And I mean, the stories, I actually had more about my father in this prior to, and then I'm thinking, well, no, I've got to sort of cut this down because his stories are legendary. You know, and he was a man of fashion and wit and poetry and writing. And my mother was a fashion photographer, once a fashion model, and they were just the glam couple. But my dad had an awkwardness around being in public. And as a result, it was painful sometimes. So one of the stories I talk about is how my father wasn't coming to my wedding. And he liked the guy. Everyone liked the guy. He was a lovely guy. And it wasn't that he didn't want me marrying him. I mean, we didn't have anything in common, but that was beside the point. But he wasn't coming. He just said, no, I'm not going. And I'm going, oh dear God, like, you know, I hate you. I absolutely hate you. And it wasn't until the morning of the wedding and that my father, he didn't even come out and tell me he was coming to my wedding. He said, hey, Christina, what clothes should I be wearing? And I go, like, are you kidding me? Like, you know, and all the only thing that's going in my mind at this particular point, do not cry. Do not cry. Do not let him make you cry. Hold it together. And you know, finally I pick out some clothes and, you know, there he is at the wedding. But he was terrified to be there. So he was an unusual man. And his humor really sort of got me through so much. And so I think where he resonates in me is I deal with a lot of my trauma, pain, heartache with humor. Yeah. And that, I think, resonates in the book.
I also thought it was a really interesting place to start this, because your parents did have, they weren't fairy tale parents, but they had a fairy tale marriage.
Yes.
You know, and yet with all of this other eccentricity and fabulousness and whatever. So, I mean, it really kind of set you up.
Well, it did, yeah, you know.
For the fall.
Yeah, well, this is it. And but my father would still say of, you know, Christina, I've been married 40 years and, you know, 30 of them happily. Like, you know, like it would be that kind of thing. So they did show me that, you know, it is possible. And, you know, my father, in my flat here in Marylebone, I have two poems that my father wrote for my mother. And when, after my parents died, I was going through my father's stuff. And actually this really inspired me to write, because my father, who had different careers, but he was a writer and he was a journalist and he had his poetry, which was all dedicated to one woman, and he had his short stories and he had his novels. And you go through this Tupperware and cardboard boxes. I think you described them as like they were like coffins of these beautiful, beautiful works. And I was sad for my father that none of it ever got to see the light of day. And he had, as gifts often for my mom, he would have poems, and they'd be embossed on beautiful paper with cherubs and hearts and stuff, and then framed and beveled. And I talk about how he had a love of one, and I had a love of many, and we both chose to write about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you got married quite early.
I did.
At
least for this generation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were totally different. I mean, you were very young. You were both totally different. I think that everyone sort of can see that or been through
right.
that or et cetera. But it started you on your work path, which was a huge part of your life.
You know, I was in production. So I started as a wardrobe stylist. And the best piece of business advice I ever got was from my mother, who said, dress for what you want to do, not for what you're doing. I don't know who initially said that, but I credit my mother with the that mantra. And my first day as a production assistant, which is at the lowest end of the long ladder upward, I came dressed in sling back heels and a linen skirt and silk blouse, and no one got me loading a truck or getting cigarettes for directors or anything. So I was very career focused, and I love my career. I had no idea where I was going. I did not, you know, say here's where I'm going. And that's the other thing I talk about, is just sometimes getting into the stream. I'll say this to my daughters, or, you know, or friends, like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. So we'll go and do something and then see what happens, right? You can't do nothing, you know? Yeah. And so I did find the advertising production world very interesting. It was crazy with stress, but it was a fun kind of stress, and you're either sinking or swimming. And
seems like it was suited to your dynamism.
Well, I think so, but like, you know, you just don't know at the time, right? Like, I mean, I came in there, and I mean, it was a crazy Wild West madman kind of thing, you know. There was, and here I am, this girl who was, you know, her hair's too big and her skirt's too short, and there was the, you know, there was the crew that could be very raunchy and offensive. First time I ever saw cocaine was at work. And it wasn't like, you know, behind the Burger King set, right? Yeah. No. Like the directors were doing a wardrobe call, like, Christina, hold the door for a second, draws a couple of lines on the table, snorts, do you want some? No, I'm good, thanks. All right, send in the next person. And it was a crazy kind of world, which I talk about. And in that world, because it was a lot of men behaving badly, and even if men weren't behaving badly, they weren't stopping the men who were behaving badly.
Yeah.
And I talk about this, you know, for lack of a better description, Me Too movement, where I had been working for the executive producer at a production company I was hired at, and he had cornered me in an elevator on a location shoot. And he was explaining to me in a very salacious way, you know, Christina, what happens on the road stays on the road. And what I tend to do is default to the defense of dumb. I am going to pretend like I do not, I am too blonde dumb as a box of hair, as I often say, you know. And finally gets to the floor, and he just rips into me. It's, what are you, fucking stupid? I'm asking you back to my room. And as a background, I mean, I actually got the job, or I was introduced to him through his wife. And I was engaged at the time, and I said, listen, I'm friends with your wife, and I'm in love, and the aftermath was horrific. Mm. And for 6 months I hung in there trying not to let it show and thinking things will go back, but he had demoted me. He stopped talking to me. I found out years later too, he had actually stopped people from giving me certain jobs. And there are a lot of women I know who have gone through exactly the same thing and worse.
I would say those were the rooms we walked through as women of our age, you know. And so when it's interesting, I mean, and those were better than the, at least we got into the room.
We did get into the room. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, and things do improve, but I think people sort of forget that those were the rooms.
Do you know, I had one time, like I was on set, and all of a sudden there was this young PA, production assistant, and he had a Polaroid camera, and I look and he's on the floor and he's taking pictures of my legs. I'm in a skirt. And I go, what the hell are you doing? And he goes, the client wants them. I said, hand me the photographs. I go over to the client. Tony, what the fuck, right? Yeah. And he goes, oh, well, you know, you got like good green legs. I go, are you kidding me? So he's got a PA taking, like, I mean, that's the kind of
the crazy level of normality.
Exactly. This is absolutely the.
There's nothing to be embarrassed about.
No.
Like, what?
Yeah.
What?
So
I asked them to take a picture of your legs. You got great legs. What?
Yeah, I know exactly. Yeah. What are you complaining about? It's a compliment.
It's a compliment.
Oh, the good old days.
Right. Before we get sidetracked on that quagmire. So you, Brandon and you are too different, too young, etc. Yeah. And then through work, you meet another man.
I do.
And that's again, sort of a little bit Mr. Darcy-ish.
He came dressed as Mr. Darcy. Mm. He was 17 years my senior, and he was worldly and educated and brilliant writer. He was a creative director of an advertising agency, and he opened me into a world that I did not even know existed. And it wasn't like I was sort of the, you know, naive, you know, never off the farm kind of girl. I traveled a lot with my parents growing up and certainly had a, you know, good education, but this was the education of life. This was the education of sex. This was the education of love and passion and sadly alcoholism and addictions. And he had a very volatile temper, and one of two things would happen when he drank, and he was always drinking, always. Like, I've never seen him without a drink. He would either become that romantic poet who would stand up and recite some glorious, you know, poem he had written, or, you know, like a silence the room, like a beautiful violin solo, or he would turn into the demon. And he was very Jekyll and Hyde. And with that came a lot of bad, but also came a lot of good. And what he, within the advertising world, because he was so much more knowledgeable than me and well more respect, I learned so much. And he opened doors, not in the sense of, okay, we're going to get you that job, Christina, but explained to me the thinking that went behind the creative minds, and really gave me the strength or the vision to see myself in the sense, well, you know, you could be doing this yourself. You know, you could be running your own show. And I had never thought about that before. So he really did empower me. You know, it's so funny when you think about these different moments in everyone's lives that were so long ago, and you go, God, I haven't thought about him or her in forever. But if you think back on it, they are an integral part of your life story.
Yeah, and I thought it was so interesting, so pivotal, because as you say, professionally and just on a on one level, huge personal growth. And then on the other level, because he was unpredictable, you're sort of sublimating your personhood and you're, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Yeah. And waiting, you know, so on one hand, you're sort of, you know, closing part of you down. On the other side, it's the true. Other one's blooming, which makes it so conflicting.
Yeah. And which is why I think we stay in those relationships. Yeah. If it were very clear.
Yeah, it was just shit. Yeah. Oh, we're not that dumb.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But you've got the good and the bad, the dark and the light, you know? Yeah. And
which also then you realize is, well, I'm also light and shade. Yeah. You know, like, no one's perfect. And then, yeah. Till you get to the point where, okay, you have to go.
Yeah.
And that came, I don't want to ruin anything for anyone, because the read, I'm just going to interject in here. It is fun, funny, hugely personal, really, really warm. Like, you really invite us in to really experience, you know, what was going on for you at those times. And it doesn't even feel like you're going back in a certain way, because to me, you sounded like your age at that age.
Right.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you reflecting back. I mean, you're exposing certain things because you can see them now.
Right.
As opposed to when you were sort of swimming upstream through them.
Yes.
But yeah, so I don't want to there's quite an explosive scene, potentially explosive scene there. And then you did found your own production company.
I did.
Tell me about that, because that was a really big part of your life.
Oh, it was a huge, you know, I really, really fortunate. Like, I mean,
first baby.
It was. So Imported Artist Film Company was my production company, and I was owned it for 25 years. And Jackson, the gentleman we were talking about, definitely was the one who encouraged me to start it. And I did. You know, I talk about life's pivot moments with questions, right? And one of the the major competitor to imported artists at the time, and number one production company at one point in the world was the Partners Film Company. And there was this fantastic, curmudgeon-y old guy named Don McLean. And probably not even old, just my perception of him being old, right? He's probably older than I am. He's probably older than I am now. And Don would play games. He hated initially the woman I was working for, and he would try and hire me. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm probably better in the den of iniquity here than the den over there. But one point he kept close. And he took me out for lunch one time after trying to hire me multiple times. He said, "Christina, what do I have to do to get you to leave McWaters, which is where I was working?" And I just thought, well, Don, you can start me up in my own production company. And he said, "Done." And that was it. So I was very fortunate that I had the Partners Film Company backing me for the first 3 years. And then I bought myself out of that relationship. And, you know, we won so many awards and produced so much work. We produced a feature film called Fugitive Pieces, which was adapted from Ann Michael's book. We had done a lot of longer format stuff, but it was mostly television commercials. And I really defined myself a lot by my career. So when that was sort of transitioning or over, I mean, you talk about now having to redefine what I call midlife, or, you know, in
what's next.
Yeah, what's next, and who am I without this?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You've been, you know, I had like collective 30 years in production. Who am I? Like, what's my next literally chapter?
And because also daily throughout those 30 years, you have been central on however many people's phones,
right,
and Rolodexes, and to their day, you were central.
It's
really, a weird feeling.
Yeah. And you know, but I love, first of all, it was a business where women were breaking through at the time. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter if you were a woman, or at least I didn't feel like it did, because you can do your job, you can do it well. And, you know, by the time I sort of, maybe about halfway or maybe 10 years into Imported, there were a lot of production companies in Canada and the States that were owned by women, and like powerful, ballsy, you know, big dick energy women. And I thought it was fantastic. And a lot of producers were women, and a lot of content. And even now you're seeing more and more of that. So I think it's terrific. So.
Which is wonderful, because that has become one of the new, I hate the phrase new normal.
Right.
But in terms of those rooms we were talking about and what was normal
right.
behavior there, it has become, and it's ubiquitously normal.
Yeah.
That changes me.
I could write a whole book just on the production world and the craziness that's happened, or the jobs that we had to do. One time I had my lovely full-time PA come in, an older guy, just a lifer, you know. And he always called me boss. He goes, "Hey, boss, I've got a bit of a situation." He's holding this glass bowl with some ice. He goes, "You know the new PA, well, you probably don't know, but there's a new PA. Well, he's chopped off his finger. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to take him to the Emerge. And go, Chuck, what have you got in the ice?" And there he had his finger in the ice.
I got my way. Just needed to tell you.
All right. Off you go, Chuck. Yeah.
Thanks for letting me know.
Exactly.
Didn't mean to hold you up.
No.
So then there's a term now, because narcissism is all the rage.
Right.
And identifying narcissism. And sort of the first act of love of a narcissist is this love bombing.
Yep.
And I would say that is something, I mean, I've never experienced it. I don't think.
You don't need to fall in love with a narcissist yet.
You know, so that was the father of my children.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I know the word narcissist is very popular today. I didn't know it back then. I did not know it until I came out of my marriage. And went for years of therapy to be explained that this is what this is. He was a card-carrying poster boy for narcissism. And he was a director at my company. This is how we met. And he was love bombing me. The last thing I wanted to do, I mean, like, absolutely last thing, was sleep with my busiest director, right? And then it all go kaboom. And then I'm going, like, I'm like, fuck, now I've lost my business. Like you know what? Like
the worst
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, exactly. I'm at
the business. Very worst thing. Like, the very worst. Exactly.
Yeah. So I was not interested at all in having a romantic relationship with him, but he was with me. So he started pursuing me, and pursuing me he did. And, you know, he has a way of wearing you down and getting everybody on that same sort of boat to wear you down. And finally, you know, pretty much after the first time I sort of agreed to go out with him. And going out with him is kind of a weird term, because we were sort of friends for a year. I think first time we went to bed together is probably the defining mm-hmm. moment. And he started proposing. And when I say proposing, he proposed over 100 times. Like, and what I learned from my first marriage was that I am not going to, I knew I wasn't supposed to get married to Brandon. Like there wasn't a single cell in me that knew I shouldn't be doing it. But whether I was just trying to sort of, you know, think it's going to get better, or maybe if my father wasn't pushing against it, I don't know exactly what, but the lesson I took away was I will never, ever get married to someone unless I'm 100% certain. So I was deflecting, you know, and, you know, John was just proposing in all sorts of inventive ways. And he was unbelievably charming and charismatic, and everyone loved him. Everyone loved him until they didn't.
I was going to say, again, I'm not going to ruin it for the reader, but some jaw-dropping comments.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when you're writing, you're supposed to show, not tell. It shows it. It may be just two or three scenes, what we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
And that was devastating.
Yeah.
I mean, you were, you know, you'd had children, you were physically sort of, you know, I think your back went.
Yeah,
one point.
Yeah,
I mean, you
I
were.
Threw my back
out. Yeah, exactly. It was just, it was such a brutal, brutal time.
It was.
For you. And you're in the wars when you have little ones.
And you know what? Here, the part of what I didn't recognize though at the time was postpartum depression, and I talk about that because my belief was, or my understanding, and it's much better now. The talk of mental health is so much better, and the charities I've been involved with back home have all done to do with mental health and addiction, whether it's with children or adults, but whole other story. But I did not recognize postpartum depression because we didn't really speak of it. And what we did speak of, I'm thinking, well, what do I have to be depressed? Like, I'm a type A, ballsy, take no shit kind of woman. I don't have, I have my own company. I'm living in a nice house. I have my health. I don't have any pressing financial concerns.
I wanted these babies.
Right,
I love these babies.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like what do I have?
What is it?
Yeah.
Like, so get a hold of yourself, woman.
Yeah. it was like, no, this isn't me. Like, yeah, this is someone else. And that was a big, important lesson, which I'm hoping other women will recognize too, is that it can happen to anybody. And it doesn't mean that you're weak. It means that you are suffering from this depression. And and the lens of which you see the world is therefore very distorted.
Yeah.
And so I think that was part of my issue, you know, because sure, everyone would like to say, oh, yeah, it's all his fault or it's all her fault, right? Yeah, no. And I think in any relationship, you do need to take inventory.
Yeah.
And where part of my issue was, which again took a long time for me to see, was dealing with postpartum depression.
Yeah.
So I'm running a you know, multi-million dollar company, and I've got, you know, two small children, and I'm suffering from depression.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all of those things can be true.
Yeah.
I'm just going to pause this because a little wire-haired dachshund is about to come through the door.
Can't wait to meet her.